And we're holding on Ches Amudeis, 9 lines from the bottom. We started talking about yesterday various dinim involving sales of fields. First, we were talking about as far as the various grades of land, Idis, Beninus, and Ziburis, which is relevant here in Bava Kamma, because we said that when a person causes hezek to somebody else and he's paying with land, then the Torah says he has to pay with Meitav, the best, and therefore that means Idis. And so we got into a whole discussion about about various details in that. So now another din having to do with sales of land and dinim that come from that. Amar Abaya, a couple of cases we're going to talk about. Amar Abaya, Reuven shemachar sadeh l'Shimon ba'achrayus. If Reuven sold a field to Shimon with achrayus, now achrayus means that he's saying if this field ends up getting taken away from you to satisfy some debt of mine, then I will reimburse you. You could have, conceivably, for example, Reuven may previously have borrowed money from somebody else, or Reuven may owe somebody else for a hezek or whatever. So then, eventually, that person might go to Reuven to try to collect, and he's not able to, for example, because Reuven doesn't have any land, or some Rishonim talk about the case we could be talking about over here, for one thing, could be where the field that he sold Shimon is a field that was designated as Akusiki, which means that it was designated, this particular one, is going to be the one on which there's the specific shibud for this debt. In any case, the point is that Reuven is selling the field to Shimon with Achrayus and saying that if this field gets taken away from you to satisfy some debt of mine, then I will reimburse you. That's called Achrayus. Elsewhere, the Gemara talks about what happens if they didn't write Achrayus in the Shtar. You have Machloikas, whether that's automatically included. The Halacha is it is, but in any case, here there is Achrayus. Now, also Balchov de Reuven v'Torach Mishimon. So now what happens eventually, sure enough, somebody that Reuven owes money to comes and takes the field away from Shimon. So now, meanwhile, in this case, Reuven is claiming that he already paid off the debt, and therefore that this Malva has no right to go and take the field away. Or he has other reasons to claim that the debt is invalid. Dinahu, Rabbi says, din is the ozo Reuven mishtoi dinabahade. Reuven has every right to go and take this other fellow, the Malva, to Beiskin and argue against him and bring whatever claims he has, whether, for example, that I already paid you off, or your shtar is forged, or whatever, or you owe me money from something else, or whatever possible claims that he could say to invalidate this guy taken away. The point is, this other fellow can't tell Reuven, you have nothing to do with this. He can't say, what's it your business? After all, I'm not taking it away from you, I'm taking it away from Shimon. If Shimon wants to take me to Beis Din with such and such arguments, fine. But you have nothing to do in a din toter with me, so I'm not obligated to even accept a summons from Beis Din when you're summoning me. So he doesn't have the right to say that. Because Reuven can say, the fact is, if you take it away from Shimon, it's bouncing back on me, because after all, I sold it to him b'achrayus. So in other words, I have a say in this matter. If you take it away from Shimon, it's not only between you and Shimon. The fact is, it ends up coming back on me as well, because Shimon in turn is going to come to me and say, you sold it to me with achrayus, reimburse me. Therefore, I have the right to begin with to take you, Levi, to Beis Din, and say that, in fact, I don't owe you this money for whatever particular claim I'm going to say. The Ikka D'Amri, others say...
What happens if in both shtar, the first lien and the second transaction were showing a charayus? What happens?
When Reuven owes money to Levi, we're not talking about Achrayus over there, because there we're talking about that Levi has a shtar where it says that Reuven owes him money. Achrayus is not relevant over there. We're saying because Levi has a shtar in his hand that says that Reuven owes him $100, then that means he's entitled to collect $100 from Reuven, and if Reuven doesn't have $100 in cash, then he has the right to go and take $100 worth of property that belongs now or used to belong to Reuven and collect it in satisfaction of the debt. Now we're saying that he...
So my question is, if the property has already a charayus...
Well, that's what we're talking about. So in other words, we're saying when Reuven sells it to Shimon, now he sells it to him by charayus. If you're talking about... So Yeah, I mean, any property that Reuven owns at the time of that the time that he takes out the loan or that he owes whatever kind of money it is all under a shibud, is all under a lien for that debt. Therefore, in principle, Levi can come and take any of it. You have the halacha that we discussed yesterday. If Reuven still owns property at the time, then when Levi comes to collect, then he has to go to Reuven. He's not allowed to go to Shimon. So here again, we could be talking about that Reuven has no more land left at all. Therefore, the Baal Chayiv can go to Shimon or to whoever else Reuven sold property to after the loan was taken out. It could also be some of the Rishonim discussed over here that we could be talking about even that Reuven does still own land, but nevertheless, we're talking about that this particular field was designated as an apusiki. It was designated as, this is the particular field that you, Levi, will have the right to collect from. So now Levi goes...
What happens if two borrowers borrowed against the same land, one after the other? What happens in that situation?
So, I mean, when Reuven owned the land, there was a shibud on it to Levi. If Shimon now owning that land, if he takes out a loan and has a shibud on it, whichever one's shtar comes first is going to be the first one to be able to collect from that land. So in that case, Levi, whom Reuven borrowed from, is going to be able to collect ahead of Yehuda, whom Shimon borrowed from, because Reuven took out the loan first.
But let's say the land is worth $1 million and the first borrower borrows $100,000. And there's another borrower borrows another $100,000 on the same land. So there's $200,000.
So then we can talk about, so I mean, obviously each one is not collecting more than what he lent. So then, fine, Beis Din will deal with, they're going to have to divide the land into pieces or whatever. Fine, we're not dealing with that right now. We're talking about, hypothetically,
it seems that from the discussion that the first borrower has access to the whole field, and
now,
once he has access to
the whole field, we're just keeping things simple. We're assuming that the amount of the loan is the equivalent value of the field. Obviously, if the loan is less than the value of the field, then we're going to have to prorate things. But we're not getting into that right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the point is, in other words, that Reuven has every right to take Levi to Beis Din and make whatever claims he wants to, and that Levi can't say, sorry, you have no business with me. My business is with Shimon. If Shimon wants to take me to Beis Din, he can. You can't, because again, Reuven is saying, makkas e makkas mine, alai hoder. If you take it away from Shimon, it ends up bouncing back on me because of the achrayus, I have to pay back Shimon. The ikka de ami, now others say, afilu shaloi ba achrayus nami. Even if Reuven had sold the field to Shimon without Achrayus, which the Gemara discusses in Bava Metzia, again, you have a different opinion. You have an opinion that says that if Achrayus was not written in the Shtar, then fine, there's no Achrayus. There's another opinion that says Achrayus tos soiperhu, that says regardless, there's always Achrayus is always implied. So therefore, it would have to be that he explicitly said no Achrayus. Even then, there's some who say that even then Reuven has the right to take Levi to Beis Din, to Omalei, because Reuven can say, I don't want that Shimon should have complaints against me, meaning, fine, I'm not actually owing Shimon any money in that case because there was no Achrayus. Nevertheless, though, I have a certain interest in this case in seeing to it that you don't take it away from Shimon, because otherwise he'll have complaints against me, so therefore that would be a valid reason also, according to that second opinion, for Reuven to take Levi to Beis Din. Tosfos points out here, Rashi, first of all, points out over here, you have to ask the question, what's the difference? Whatever arguments Reuven could make to say that the loan is not valid, whether he's going to claim that the shtar is forged, whether he's going to say he paid it back already, whatever the case, whatever claims that Reuven makes, Shimon could just as well make as well. So what's the difference whether Reuven or Shimon takes him to Beis Din? Either way, the same claims are going to be brought up. Rashi gives the answer Rashi doesn't say over here, but in other places, Rashi explains, for example, you have Reuven can be making a tainus bori, Shimon will be making only a tainus shema. Namely, Reuven can say, I know for a fact that I paid you back this debt already, and I even have aid for that. Shimon might be able to say only a tainus shema. I'm claiming that Reuven paid you back the debt. I don't have any evidence of it. I wasn't involved at the time, but I'm claiming that maybe Reuven paid it back, and therefore if you want to take away the land, you have to prove to the contrary. A tainus bori is obviously going to be stronger. Tosfos over here points out some other considerations as well. One of them might be, suppose that Shimon, there may come a point when Beis Din says to Shimon, look, if you have any proofs that you want to say that Levi shouldn't take this land away from you, then go ahead and bring those proofs. Let's say there comes a point, Shimon says, you know what, I don't have any. But Reuben may have. So Shimon, then we're going to say, well, sorry, you don't have any proofs. We're going to have to judge the case accordingly. But Reuben, meanwhile, Reuben is not bound by that. So if Reuben comes later on and finds Adin, then he will be able to bring them to Beis Din. Also, another possibility, Tosfos says, practically speaking, what happens, for example, suppose the Malva says, you know what, I want to go to the Beis Din HaGadol and for them to judge it, so that way, because if we go to a lesser Beis Din, you're going to later on say, I want to appeal it to a higher Beis Din, so I want to go to the Beis Din HaGadol. Let's say, for example, that Shimon is not able to, but Reuben is able to. And then there are different other points that Tosfos brings in other places and that other Rishonim bring in other places, to say why it's an advantage for Reuben to be able to go and not Shimon. One of them might be a practical matter. Let's say Tosfos mentions, suppose that very simple, Reuben might be a sharper kind of guy. He's better able to argue in Beis Din than Shimon is. So therefore, it's to his advantage to be able to go rather than leaving it up to Shimon. And you have various other examples as well. They point out, let's say, for example, Reuben's claim is I already paid back. Well, if it's Shimon taking it to Beis Din, Levi might have the ha'azah. He might have the goal to say, no, that's not true. But if it's in front of Reuben, who actually paid him, then he might not have the chutzpah to say that. So therefore, that would be another point. So there are several different reasons why there's an advantage to Reuben being able to go. The Stipler, by the way, points out over here a couple of lumdish points over here. It's true that the whole thing is triggered originally by Reuben borrowing money. Nevertheless, that wouldn't be enough to make him consider the Baal Dover were it not for the considerations that we're saying here in the Gemara. And on the other hand, we're saying, even though usually Tarumas in the second version of the Gemara, usually saying the other guy's going to have a complaint about me is not enough reason to make him be considered a Baal Dover, to make him have an interest in the matter. But here again, given that the whole thing started with him borrowing money, then therefore even that reason of Tarumas is reason enough for us to say that he should be able to be involved with you. To complain that Shimon is going to say, you sold me a field and now it was taken away from me. Va'omer Abaye. Now Abaye says another din, also involving sales of land. Reuben Shemachar sold to Shimon Shaloi Ba'achrayus. Suppose the field was sold without Achrayus. So again, therefore, if it gets taken away from Shimon, then Shimon has no recourse against Reuben. The Yotzu, Allah, Asikin, and now Asikin came out against the field. Asikin, Rashi says, means Uri, means complainers, people who are arguing that the field belongs to them and not to Reuben. Tosfos makes a point and says, it doesn't mean like the mafia who are going to force Shimon to give them the field illegally. In that case, then it wouldn't matter, Achrayus or not. Reuben's not going to be responsible for such a thing. Achrayus only includes things where it's because of Reuben. Here it would not. So we're talking about that these people are claiming that Reuben stole the field from them or whatever, that somehow it's not that somehow the sale, there's something wrong with the sale when Reuben sold it to Shimon in the first place. This word Asikin, by the way, is related to, we have in this coming week's parasha, and told us we have about Yitzchak's well, Kis Asku Imari, that they argued with him, the Plishtim, claiming this well belongs to us. That's the same word Asikin as we have over here in the Gemara. Anyway, Rashi points that out in Bava Metzia because this Gemara is also there.
But how is he able to get the field if the...
So the claim is, so let's say, for example, the claim is that he stole it from them, that previously this field belonged to them, and Reuben illegally took it away from them and is now claiming that it's his and now went and turned around and sold it to Shimon. Whatever the case
is, illegally that
they're claiming that Reuben owns it illegally. They're claiming, Rashi says, Reuben loyim shalonovi. They're saying it belongs to us, and Reuben had no right to sell it to Shimon in the first place. Well, the din is, says Abaye, ad shalai hechzikva, before Shimon made a chazaka in that field, yochol lachzibay, then he's able to retract and say, you know what, I don't want to buy this field after all, because I don't need to be dealing with these asikin. You take it back and you deal with them. Misha hechzikva, once he made a chazaka in it, ein yochol lachzibay, then he cannot change his mind anymore. Tosfos discusses over here, are we talking about where he didn't pay for the field yet, or are we talking about maybe even where he did even pay for the field, Tosfos discusses. actually, Toys just ends up saying, we are talking about when he did, when he didn't give money. If he did give money, then even with Achrayus, he shouldn't be able to change his mind, because after all, there has to come a point when the sale is irrevocable. Not all Rishonim agree with that. In particular, Hagoyis Hagra brings that the Rambam holds, even if he gave money, then still he would be able to change his mind. Anyway, but Mishah Hechzik, well, once he made a chazaka, in Yocholach Zabar, then he can't change his mind. My timer, to Omer Le, because Reuven can tell him, you know what, look, you bought this field without Achrayus, Chaisa de Kitvi Sabres for Kiblos. You figured that you're buying a tied up bag, which turns out to be full of air, you figured that you're getting that, and sure enough, exactly, that's exactly what you're getting. In other words, basically, he's telling Shimon, you took a risk, because after all, you bought the field without Achrayus, so therefore, you took a risk that there might be, that something might go wrong, and you're not going to have it. Well, it turns out, it's the equivalent of like buying an empty bag, it's like the equivalent of buying a closed bag, a sealed bag, tied up, where you don't know what's inside it. It could contain treasures, but it could also contain something, it could also be just empty, and you bought it, and sure enough, it turns out that you made a bad deal. In other words, it's not my fault. If you had bought it with Achrayus, fine, I'd have to reimburse you. But because you bought it with Shalom Achrayus, you took your chances and tough luck, basically. There is an interesting explanation, in fact, that this expression, Chaisa de Kitri, goes back to a story involving the Shlokish. We learned in Gittin a story. We learned a story in Gittin involving Rish Lakish, that at one point Rish Lakish ended up among a band of Ludim, cannibals, and the Gemara describes over there how he managed to wipe them all out. Basically, what he did is they had a rule that whoever, that any person they're going to kill, they're going to give him his last wish. So he told them his last wish is that he wants to take a bag and hit each one with it 1.5 times. They didn't realize that inside the bag was a very heavy weight. So he actually used that bag to kill them, to kill them one by one. But they thought he's just going to, like, as a symbolic thing, almost like he's going to have the satisfaction of hitting them with an empty bag, which is nothing. And they didn't realize. So some say that this expression, the Gemara over here, Chaisa de Kitri, Sabres for Kiblos, comes from that. You thought it's just a bag with a bunch of knots in it. You didn't realize that, in fact, you're going to get a zetz from it. The point is, in other words, that Reuven has every right to say to Shimon that you took your chances. If you wanted a guarantee that you're not going to lose your money, you should have bought the field by Achrayus. And you would have paid extra for that Achrayus. Achrayus, no, meaning in other words that when you buy a field with Achrayus, means that I'm taking responsibility that I reimburse you. But you would pay extra for that. You want to buy without Achrayus. So means you bought it cheaply. Yeah, you didn't, yeah. So it's your tough luck. So the Gemara continues, at what point is it considered that Shimon has done chazaka? Once he stepped on the edges of the field. Now, Rashi elsewhere and Tosfos over here explains that he walked all around the field to look at it and see the quality of the land over there. So that's considered that he made a chazaka on it. The Rif has a different explanation, and the Rambam explains similarly what it means is, the way they usually had in those times, between one field and the next, there would be a pile of dirt, a berm of dirt raised up, running along the length of the field between one field and the next. So now the person buys a field, the pasha says he has another field next door, and now he's going to make one big field out of it. He takes that nature and he tramples it down to make it smooth, to smooth it out relative to the rest of the karka. The rif and the ramam hold, that's what it means over here, v'kidai shametsu. So that's considered that he did chazak. Now, Tosfos points out, usually we talk about chazaka as the way to buy karka, and we know from other Gemaras what chazaka is. What does the Gemara mean over here? What is chazaka? And why is the Gemara giving a different definition here than usually what it means? Usually, chazaka on a field would be, for example, he starts digging in the field or various other things. And so Tosfos answers, what it means is that because here we're talking about, again, Tosfos holds that we're talking about he didn't give the money yet. But still, usually a person still has in mind, even though he made a full-fledged kinyan on it, Tosfos holds he didn't give money, the Rambam holds he did give money, whatever, even though he made a full-fledged kinyan, he still has in mind, if there are oderim, if there's going to be objections like that, it's one thing if, for example, somebody comes and says, Reuven owes me money, therefore I'm going to take away the field. Fine, the sale at least was legitimate. Here you have Odin who are claiming the sale as a whole was illegitimate, so he has in mind, it's implied in the sale conditions that he's going to be able to change his mind. So once Daish HaMetzri, then it's too late for him to change his mind. But before Daish HaMetzri, even though he's done some other chazaka on the field, and thereby done a kinyan, nevertheless, he still has that out to say, if it turns out that the sale was invalid, then I can undo it.
What does it mean? He had the fiancé, but he didn't buy it.
Because you can have, there's very, because you can have, in Kiddushin, the Gemara, the Mishnah explains that you can acquire land with Kesef, Shtar, or Chazaka. So there could be where he paid the money and did not yet do Chazaka. Could be the other way around. He did Chazaka, but didn't yet pay the money. Now this would only apply if he sold it shaloi ba'achrayus. Av ba'achrayus loy, but if he bought it with achrayus, then we would say that not, he doesn't have the right to change his mind, because on the contrary, this opinion says if it was ba'achrayus, then no, even if he already made the chazaka, he would still be able to change his mind, because the fact is it's ba'achrayus, and therefore that implies that he's going to get reimbursed. But he's saying that, look, why should Rashi elsewhere explains, in other words, why should we bother? What are we going to tell the Dayanim? We're going to allow these other people to take the field from me, and therefore I'm going to have to come back to you for the money. Instead of doing that a whole rigmarole, just give me back my money in the first place. You take back the field, and then if these people are claiming you stole the field from them, you go with them to Beis Din and work it out. The Ikka de Amri Afilu Bachrayus Nami, others say that in fact, no, even if Shimon bought it Bachrayus, still Reuven can say, I don't have to take the field back and give you back your money, De Omale, because you can tell them, Afi Tirpach, Vashalamach, show me your Shtar Tirpach, show me that Beis Din actually gave them permission to take away the field from you, then I'll reimburse you under the terms of the Achrayus. Just because they're claiming, people can claim lots of things, they may not necessarily win the case in Beis Din. Yes, I sold it to you, Bachrayus, but that still doesn't mean that the first time somebody comes with a claim, I right away have to exercise the Achrayus clause and pay you back for it. You give me back the field. No, you hold on to the field. Let them take you to Beis Din. You go through the whole thing. If it turns out that they wind up taking it away from you, then fine, I'll reimburse you. Then we'll deal with it then. But just because they're making claims doesn't obligate me necessarily to take back the field. So all that was a digression from the part that we were talking about that a mazik has to pay with meitav. So now the Gemara returns to that point. Rav Huna Omer, oy kesef, oy meitav. Rav Huna says that either the person pays money or he pays meitav, or he pays with the best of his land. Now, Rashi explains that Rav Huna is referring all the way back to what we started discussing on Daf Zayin. We're now on Daf Tes. Back on Daf Zayin, the Gemara had brought a point that on the one hand, the Pasuk says you have to pay with Meitav, the best of your land. On the other hand, we have the Pasuk Yishalim, which means that he can pay with anything. We said even grain. So we started dealing with the question of what all that means, and that led us into this whole discussion of Idis, Veninus, and Ziburis. And now Rashi says, now we're getting back to that point. And saying, Rav Huna is saying, it means either you have to pay money or you have to pay meitav. So the only reason why we waited 2 blocks to discuss this is because first we were discussing what exactly meitav is, according to Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Akiva, and that led us into this whole discussion of Idis, Veninus, and Ziburis, and now therefore we're getting back to that. Tosfos explains differently that what it is it actually goes back to what we learned. It doesn't go back quite that far. It goes back to, we said before, that at the end of the sugya, about the question, what does it mean that he can pay meitav, and on the other hand, he can pay with subin. I mean, we said Rav Papa and Rav Huna Bered Rav Yeshua had said that any metaltlin are considered meitav, even brain. So now Rav Huna is saying, no, I disagree with that, and I'm saying that only that you have to pay either with money or with meitav. So therefore, it wouldn't go back all the way to the beginning of the sugya, but rather to the end of the previous sugya. And again, because the Gemara had digressed to talk about this whole matter of Idis, Veninus, and Ziburis, and the various details with them. So then the question becomes, by the way, who the halacha is like. Tosfos says, on the face of it, the halacha has to be like Rav Papa and Rav Huna Bered Rav Yeshua, that all metaltlin are considered meitav because they're later on than Rav Huna, and we have the general rule among the beginning from the time of the later Amiroyim, the halacha is usually like the later opinion. On the other hand, Rabbi Natan says not, you have to either pay kesef or meitav. If you don't have either one, then you pay subin, then you can pay with brain. The Ramah, we talked about the other day, holds similarly. He says the mazik does not have the option of paying with subin. If all he has is that, then fine. But if he has money, he has to pay with money or with meitav, which would be like Rav Huna over here. But most Rishonim learn not like that, and they learn the halacha is, in fact, that you can give any metaltlin to begin with. So the Gemara says, Eis Fed Abnachman Larapuna. So Abnachman says, what do you mean that he has to pay either money or Meitav? We learned before, Yoshev Larabas Shava Kesef Afilu Subin. Didn't we say the word Yoshev means that he can pay with anything that has monetary value, even with bran? And the answer is Hochmeisen and Delesley. The answer is we're talking about over here where the Mazik doesn't have anything else. All he has available to pay with is bran. He doesn't have money. He doesn't have fields. Well, the Gemara asks you Delesley Pshita. Well, of course, if he doesn't have anything else, of course it's Pasha to can pay with that. What else is he supposed to pay with? The answer is Mao de Tema. Without Braisa telling us Yoshev Rabbis Shavah Kesef, you would have thought Aminamai, we should tell this Mazik, Zil Torach Zabin Vaisila Kesef. Maybe you have to go to the trouble of selling that subin, of selling that bran, and converting it to cash, and then go give him money. Kamash Malon, and therefore we're saying he doesn't have to do that. So he doesn't have to do that. He can give the subin because that's what he has right now. So now, again, you have the Machlokas Rishonim. If he has subin and he has money, is he allowed to give subin? Tosfot, Rabbi Natan, and the Ramah hold that not. Most of the Rishonim hold that he could. But here we're saying, if he only has subin, even Rav Huna is going to agree, because the Braisa says, Yoshev Rabbis Shavah Kesef Afilu Subin, he can give those subin, rather than Beis Din is not going to tell him, you have to go sell those subin for money, and then give him money, he's entitled to give the subin in that case. Okay. Continues the Gemara. Omer Rav Asi, Ksofim Harein Kitarka. Money, says Rav Asi, is considered like karka. Well, we have to figure out, what does that mean? As far as what halacha is Rav Asi talking about, is he talking about regarding this matter of Meitav? And we're saying, in other words, that since the Torah says that he pays with Meitav, with the best of his land, then instead he can pay with money. Well, then that's exactly the same thing Rav Huna is saying. So why is Rav Asi saying that as an independent statement? Why does he just say, I agree with Rav Huna?
Karka is land,
yeah. Ella, rather, we have to say, maybe Rav Asi is talking about L'shnei Acham Shecholchu. You have to realize, by the way, a lot of times the Amoraim often will say a very brief statement because they can rely on their Talmidim to figure out what they're talking about. So we, now, when Ravina and Rav Ashi compose the Gemara for us, they have to figure out for us, who are not going to be on that level, to figure out what was the context in which Rav Asi said his din. So now, maybe Rav Asi is talking about a din where two brothers divide up an estate, or actually Rav Hanano and the Rif have a gil, so it's three brothers anyway. One of them gets a, let's say for example here we're talking about two, the three actually may come up later on. Anyway, let's say for example that two brothers divided up their father's estate. One of them got land, one of them got money. Suppose that now a Baal Choyv, whom their father owed money to, comes and takes the karka, and he would do that, because after all, he doesn't have a shibud on the Taltlin. Eventually, in the time of the Gaonim, they made a takana to the contrary, but in the times of the Gemara, the rule was that when a person borrows money, there's an automatic shibud on all the land he owns, but not on his metalplin. So metalplin is movables. Yeah. So now the Baal Choyv comes and takes the land in satisfaction of the debt. And again, to address your point before Avraham Moshe, let's keep things simple and assume that we're talking about that the value of the debt is equal to the value of the land, because yeah, obviously, otherwise we're not talking about the full land. But here, let's say we're talking about that he owes 1,000 and the land is in fact worth 1,000. So let's say you're going to say that. And you're going to say, therefore, so you have the two brothers, Reuben and Shimon, inherited from their father. Now we're saying somebody that their father owed money to went and took all the karka in payment of the debt. And you're going to tell me from Shimon. And now you're going to say that Shimon can go to Reuben and demand from him half the money. So at least he's not completely out all of his Yerusha. Well, the question is, pshita. Isn't that obvious that he can do that? What do you think? Is one of them a son and one of them not? The fact is, both of them equally have a chiyuv to pay off their father's debt. Obviously, they have to pay the whole. The point is, in other words, their father owed 1,000. Their father owed 1,000. He left an estate of 2,000, 1,000 of karka and 1,000 of money. So Reuven took all the karka, Shimon took all the money. Now we're saying that the Baal Choyv came and took the 1,000 worth of karka from Reuven. Baal Choyv, somebody that their father owed money to.
Oh. Yeah.
So now, of course, Reuven can come to Shimon and say, look, then in that case, am I left without a Yerusha? You have to give me 500 out of the 1,000 of money that you took. Of course, what is one of them a son and one of them is not? Both of them have an equal chiyuv to pay off their father's debt.
You can't say that one of them has three.
Yeah. So, in fact, Tosfos points out, obviously, now it's true that the Gemara is going to mention soon an opinion of Shmuel that says differently. However, what the Gemara is saying is, when you're talking about when they divided up the karka, you can say that maybe you could say, let's say, for example, you can have a case where two of them got karka and one of them got money, and then one of them's karka was taken away. You can say maybe they had in mind to begin with to that they'll do that. He's taking his chances. But here, where one got karka and one got money, even Shmuel is not going to say that the whole debt is going to be on one of them. Obviously, they had in mind that if the one who gets the karka gets it taken away, that he's going to be able to get reimbursed by the other one. So what's the chiddush then that Rav Asi is saying? So the answer is the question is, why would Rav Asi even have to be saying that? Isn't it fairly obvious? If we're talking about a case of two brothers inheriting, of course, Ksafim Harem Kakarka, the money is like a karka in the sense that if a karka gets taken away, he's entitled to be reimbursed for the money. Ikadamri, others say, Adrab al Idachisa. On the contrary, you could argue that maybe, in fact, you could say the din might be the other way around. On the contrary, you could argue not pshita. On the contrary, you could argue that there's no reason the din should be that way. After all, Shimon should be able to say the amalei lahochi shakli ksopim. After all, you know what? Why did I decide to take money? Why didn't I just say I'll take 500 of land and 500 of money? Because the imignavi lemishtalam neminach. Because I knew I'm taking chances. If that money gets stolen, I'm not going to be able to come to you and say, give me half the land. You're going to tell me that's your problem. Or ulahochi shaklas ara. Well, on the other hand, you were willing to take the land. You're also taking a risk with it. If it gets taken away from you in payment of our father's debt, I shouldn't have to reimburse you. So according to that logic, not that Rav Asi's din is poshut. On the contrary, there's no reason to say that the din should be that way. Reuven should not have the right to go to Shimon and demand half of Shimon's money, because Shimon could say, look, each of us took something. We were taking a risk. And the same way, I was taking a risk where I wouldn't have recourse against you, the same way you shouldn't have recourse against me. So one way or the other, however we look at it, either Rav Asi's din is very poshut, or it's impossible. Either way, what is Rav Asi saying? Ella rather, we can say there's another case. L'shnei acham shachoku, suppose you have two brothers divided up the estate. Fine, so this time, each one got part of the estate in money and part of it in karka. Or ba'al chayv noto chelka shel echa mehen. And a ba'al chayv came and took the portion of one of them. So he didn't take the whole Yerusha, but he took the land that the one had inherited. Now, here's where Rabbeinu Hanano brings a girsa that we're actually talking about. There were three brothers over here. So you have three brothers where you have Reuven, Shimon, and Levi, and now the Baal Choy came and took the land from one of them. So according to the girsa we have in front of us in the Gemara, would be that there were two brothers. Anyway, the point is, because the difference is that when you have three, then you can say that maybe you don't have to undo, that we're going to talk about, do we start all over again? Do we redivide what's left among all three of them, or maybe not? Maybe when there's two brothers, you have more reason to do that, because one, again, has lost his entire Yerusha. When there's three brothers, and among them, each one got some karka, maybe there's less reason to say that.
But if he takes from one guy's Yerusha, then he's...
Well, that's what we have to figure out. So you're going to say in that case, Rav Asi is saying, Sofim Harem Kakarka, you're going to say that Rav Asi is saying that he is entitled to be reimbursed for part of the karka that he was taking. But they don't have to give him karka necessarily. He can be given money. The question is, in that case, why does Rav Asi have to say that? Well, Amar Rav Asi Choda Zimna. In that case, Rav Asi already said the same thing in another case. The Itmar, as we have a discussion, Ha'achim Shachoku, exactly that case. Brothers divided up the land that they inherited from their father. Ubo Baal Choyv Noto Chalka Shal Echa Mehen. A Baal Choyv came and took the portion of one of them. So we have a three-way Machloikas. What happens? Rav Oma Botla Machloikas. Rav says, And Tosfos points out, by the way, again, you can talk about that this particular field the Baal Choyv took wasn't Apusiki. It was designated as the one from which the debt was going to be paid off. So therefore, so now, so what happens though? The fact is, now this guy is out the land that he inherited. So Rav Amar Batla Machlokas. Rav says that the whole division is void because now part of it was because now his portion was taken away. Therefore, Rav says we have to start all over again. You can't say that the other brother or brothers are going to keep the land, and they're going to say we can just compensate him with money. It doesn't work that way. Rav is going to say you have to start all over again. Tosfos also points out, by the way, now, if there's money available, why don't we just buy back the field from the Baal Choyv and have done with it? Why do we have to go through this whole rigmarole of starting all over again? Why wouldn't Rav say, look, what are we talking about over here? The field that the Baal Choyv took away was worth 1,000, let's say. So fine, we're going to talk about, so Rav is saying now, so we started, let's say, for example, we started with $2,000 worth of land. Each brother got $1,000. To keep things simple, by the way, we're also talking about there's no Bechor over here, because if there's Bechor, there's a whole other matter. So let's keep things simple and assume that neither of them was a Bechor. Anyway.
There was
no Bechor. There was a sister born first. There was a miscarriage first. Whatever, there was any number of kids. Whatever. Right? Yeah. Anyway, the point is, so to keep things simple, we're talking about, let's say, two brothers, and each of them got $1,000 worth of karka. Now we're saying the Bechor came and took $1,000 away. Now,
no money?
So let's say there was no money. Let's say there was only karka. Yeah. But well, so now though, Reuven, who still has his land, also has money. So what are we saying over here? So now Rav Asi is going to say that he is entitled to compensation in money, meaning that Reuven is going to take some money and give it to Shimon in to make up for the fact of what was taken away from Shimon. Now, the point is, Tosfos says, why do we have to do that? Why doesn't Reuven just go to the Baal Choyv, buy back the land from him, and then Shimon still has his land? And the answer is, Tosfos says, that's true. However, we could be talking about, for example, where meanwhile that Malva has sold it to somebody else, or bequeathed it as a Yerusha to somebody else. He died in between, and his son inherited it. The fact is, they don't have the right then to necessarily go and buy it. They could, if he's willing to sell it back, sure, but he's not obligated to. As long as the Baal Choyv himself has the land, he's obligated as a matter of halacha to accept money and return the field. But here, if he already sold it to somebody else or gave it as a present or bequeathed it as a yerusha to somebody else, then that doesn't happen. So now we have to be talking about the case. What is Shimon exactly entitled to?
Why is it not just when the Reuven passes away, he should make like a whole chesed with the Baal Choyv?
Well, talking about their father did not pay off the Baal Choyv ahead of time. He passed away. Reuven and Shimon, his sons, inherited his property. And now the Baal Choyv came and took it away from Shimon. So now we have to figure out what happened. So Rav Amar Batla Machlokas, Rav says the whole division is null and void. We have to start all over again. We take the remaining land that's left, and we divide it equally between Reuven and Shimon. Well, Shmuel Amar Viter. On the other hand, Shmuel says, no, he's lost out. He took his chances. He got a piece of land, especially like Tosfos is saying, it was Shimon, whose land was taken away from him. He, especially according to Tosfos, he got land that was in Akusiki, but even if that was designated for the Baal Choyv, but even if not, the point is, in other words, he took his chances. He got karka, and therefore tough luck. Rav Asi, Amar Noto, Ravia Bakarka, or Ravia Bamoris. Rav Asi says, he's going to get either a quarter of the land or a quarter of the money. So Rashi explains actually two explanations. One is that we mean Revia Bakarka or Revia Bamaris means one or the other. Either he's entitled to a quarter of his portion in money, in land, or a quarter in cash for reasons that we're going to explain in a minute why he would say one or the other. Rashi brings a second explanation of that it means he gets a quarter of the, of Karka and a quarter of Mars. And we'll explain soon why that is. Anyway, so let's figure out why each one says what he says. Rav Amar Batla Machlokas. Why does Rav say the whole division is null and void? Because Kasava, he takes the view, Ha'achim Shechoku Ki Yoshim Havu. When brothers divide up the estate, they're considered like Yoshim. Meaning, in other words, each one has an equal obligation to pay the Baal Choyv. Therefore, why should it be that one of them has to suffer the loss and then take the whole thing on himself? Both of them have to, and therefore you have to start all, therefore you have to redivide all over again. Ushmulam Viter, why does Shmuel say that he forfeited and he lost out? Because Kasava, he holds Ha'achim Shechoku Lokuchas. He holds that when brothers divide up, it's considered as though they bought property from each other. each other. Meaning, with small figures like this, when we say kiyoshim damu, it means, in effect, what we're saying is, as soon as the father, now, when the father died, we didn't know yet which son is going to get which portion of the land. Afterwards, they worked it out among themselves. Rav says, in effect, what we consider is retroactive to when the father died, this is called yesh breira, we consider that whatever Reuben ends up getting is what was meant for him all along from when the father died. And similarly with what Shimon got. On the other hand, Shmuel holds, it's the equivalent of as though they bought their properties from each other. As if Reuben is saying, I will trade you this piece of land for that land.
And Reuben is the brother? Or?
Both of them, Reuben and Shimon, are the two brothers.
And Achim is
the Baal Chayim is somebody else. We didn't give him a name. So now, Shmuel holds that when Reuben and Shimon divide up the estate, in effect, each one is saying, I am trading you for this. I'm trading you your part for my part. So therefore, they're considered like buyers. Meaning, in other words, that each one of us had an equal right to all this property, but we can't because we have to divide it up somehow. So therefore, I'm trading. You're going to get the north part. I'm going to get the south part. But that means, in other words, I'm trading. I could have taken the north part, but instead I'm letting you have the north part and I'll take the south part and vice versa. So therefore, Shmuel holds they're considered like buyers. Well, since they're like buyers, then he lost out. Yeah. So in fact, it's the equivalent of buying without achrayus. Because when they do this division, there's no achrayus involved. Nobody's saying, they're not making a deal, I'll reimburse you in case something happens. So therefore, tough luck. Why does Rav Asi say that he gets a quarter of the land or a quarter of the money? Because he's not sure. Do we go like Rav? Do we go like Shmuel? So therefore, it's one of those cases, a moment on multiple suffix. We have a suffix on the money, and therefore chokim. Therefore, we divide it up. Therefore, he gets either a quarter of. Therefore, he gets either. So Shimon, whose land was taken away from him, is claiming from Reuben, they took away 1,000 from me. Therefore, we have to store it all. Therefore, we should do like Rav, and we should store it all over with the remaining 1,000 of land, and you'll get half. You'll get 500, and I'll get 500. Now, Rav Asi is saying, because of the suffix, he's entitled to 250. The 250 can be either in land. Reuben can take 250 worth of land and give to him, or he can give him 250 in cash.
According to Rav, Rav says that 1% is to pay for the whole thing.
No, Rav is saying on the contrary, but the machlokes, we start the division all over again.
Yeah.
We say, in other words, that both of them are responsible to pay.
What does
Rav Asi? Rav Asi is saying that he gets half. Rav Asi is saying, Rav is saying like this. You started out with an estate worth 2,000.
Right.
Each of them got 1,000 of it. The Baal Chayv came and took 1,000 worth of land all from Shimon. Now, Rav is saying, we have 1,000 left of land, we store it all over again, Reuben gets 500 of that land, Shimon gets 500 of that land. So it comes out, each of them has paid 250 towards the Baal Chayv. So Shmuel is saying that, no. Shmuel is saying Shimon forfeited and tough luck. He's left with nothing. Rav Asi is saying, there's a suffix over here. Do we go like Rav or like, how do we look at it like Rav or like Shmuel?
Yeah.
Therefore, he's entitled to 250 from his brother. The 250 is half of 500. So therefore, either Reuben can say, I'll give you 250 of land, or Reuben can say, I'll give you 250 of cash.
And Rashi holds
that. That's Rashi's first explanation. Rashi's second explanation is that it means, either way, the point is that Rav Asi is saying that Sofim Haran to Kauke. He's saying that you can give money or you can give Kauke. So in that case, if Rav Asi is saying before Sofim Haran to Kauke, what is he adding by that? Or beyond what he's saying here.
What's Rashi trying to add? That is, they both want money and...
That was Rashi's second explanation. Hold on. There's two explanations in Rashi. Rashi's first explanation is it's one or the other. Sometimes a vav in Gemara terminology means or. Rashi's second explanation is it does mean both. It means he gets both. It means he gets 250 of land and 250 of character. The point is, can Shimon say, I demand 500 of character? Or can he say, no, I'm not a new, or so can Reuben say, can Shimon say, I demand 500 of Kauka and Reuben has to do that? Or can Shimon say, I demand 500 and Reuben tells him, sorry, you're not entitled to anything. So therefore, sort of Ashi appoints the second opinion and Ashi splits the difference and says, he is entitled to 500. However, he's not entitled to say, I want the 500 in Kauka. Reuben can say, I'm willing to give you 500, fine, but I'm not going to do it all in money. I'm going to give some of it to you in cash and some of it to you in land. And Rav Asi says that Shimon has to be willing to accept that. Rashi prefers the first version.
But the second version, he's trying to add that he should get...
So according to the second version in Rashi, he's getting 500. 250 in cash and 250 in land.
And then what about the first revenge? Getting...
That we're talking about Reuben and Shimon.
I'm saying that they're gonna get 1,000 and Reuben are gonna get 250.
The point is, according to Rashi's first explanation, after the Baal Chayiv took his 1,000 and you have 1,000 left of the estate, according to Rashi's first explanation, Reuben is ending up with 750 and Shimon is ending up with 250. According to Rav Asi. Because we're saying that we'll have a suffix. Should he get 500 or should he get 0? So we split the difference and say he gets 250. The 250 can be either in land or in caravan. But that's how it is, according to Rav Asi, because it's a suffix. According to Rashi's second explanation, they are each ending up with 500, but Reuben has the option of saying, I don't want to give you 500 worth of my land, I will give you 250 worth of my land, and the other 250 will be in cash.
So he's getting from both.
So he's getting from Reuben,
right.
But one in land and one in cash. So the point is, in other words, so that's a mishapkale, so he has a suffix. Ike Yoshin Domi, Ike Lakochas Domi. Are they considered like Yoshin or are they considered like buyers? Therefore, says Rav Ashi, he gets a quarter of karka or a quarter of mos, according to Rashi's first explanation, and according to Rashi's second explanation, a quarter of karka and a quarter of mos. Anyway, the point is.
What's the suffix exactly? What is it? Whether the Yoshim or the buyers?
The suffix is, do we go like Rav and consider them Yoshim, or do we go like Shmuel and consider them Lakochas? If we consider them like Yoshim, then each one is entitled to half of the estate. If we consider them like Lakochas, then we'll say you bought Shaloi Bachrayus, and therefore tough luck.
So Rav
Asi is doing both because he's not sure. The point is,
It can be either one or the other, but it has to be only one.
No,
either Yoshim or they're not Yoshim.
No, we have a concept in halacha called mamon hamutal b'safek. Sometimes we have a case where there's a safek on money. When you have one of them is more muchzak than the other, then fine, then we don't say that. Here Tosfos just briefly says, d'loy shayach vea, motzi mechaveiro l'maraya. It's not relevant to talk about motzi mechaveiro because neither one to begin with is more muchzak than the other because both of them, because their father owed this money from beforehand. We have a concept called in a case where neither one is muchzak, we say moment on multiple suffix choking, and then we say we divide it evenly. So Rav Asi is doing that. He's dividing evenly and saying therefore that he's entitled to half, but that half can be either in karka or in mos, or according to Rashi's second explanation, he is entitled to his full share, but it doesn't have to all be in karka. Anyway, the point is that Rav Asi cannot be saying Ksofim Harem Kakarka because he already explained that over here. There's no reason for him to again say Ksofim Harem Kakarka when he already made his opinion clear in this case. El Amai Harem Kakarka in and Meitav. So we have to go back to the understanding of Rav Asi when he says Ksofim Harem Kakarka, he means regarding the din of paying for Meitav, regarding the din of Nezikin. Well, the question is, Yehochi Haimu de Rav Huna. Well, in that case, and that's exactly the same thing as Rav Huna said earlier on the Amud. And the answer is, Eima, you're right. B'chein Amar Rav Asi, we have to say Rav Asi's statement is not being said as an independent statement. Rather, we have to say the same thing as Rav Huna. Rav Asi said the same point by saying, he phrased it differently than Rav Huna.
He's saying the same thing.
Okay. Having brought a din of Rav Huna as far as money, the Gemara brings another din of Rav Huna also as far as money, also as far as spending money on things.
But why couldn't I just say that Rav Asi agrees with Rav Huna?
But that's what we tried to do that in the first place, but we assumed that if the Gemara is presenting Rav Asi's statement as an independent statement, then it had to be something different. Now the Gemara is saying, we have to understand that's what it is. It was meant just to corroborate Rav Huna's statement. Okay. Amr of Zera, Amr of Huna, the mitzvah ad shlish. When it comes to a mitzvah, a person has to be prepared to pay up to one third. So the Gemara says, my shlish, what does that mean exactly? Ilema shlish besai, does that mean that a person has to be prepared to pay up to one third of the value of his house, which is to say of his whole property? So in other words, that if a person has So say, for example, a person has $1,000 to his name, and let's say, for example, it comes to buying an esrog for Sukkos or matzah for Pesach or whatever, he has to be prepared to spend up to $333. The question is, elamayata, by that logic, so what happens if a person has three mitzvahs in front of him, lace of a kulig, they say, does he have to give away all of his property? You don't really have that. You don't have a chiyuv. You don't really have a chiyuv of paying so much for mitzvahs. We have, for example, when it comes to tzedakah, you pay meiser, you pay at most choymesh, 1/5, and you're not supposed to. I'm a vazvaz, al yivazvaz, yosim a choymesh. You're not supposed to spend more than 20% of your resources on tzedakah. So why all of a sudden are we saying over here that you should be paying 1/3 of your property of your resources for one mitzvah?
What do you mean by that? That I was saying that's much.
Don't I have to get? Now, the Rebbe is talking about that if you're doing for the sake of tshuva, then that's different. Fine, but the point is when you're doing it for the sake of the mitzvah, here we're talking about you have a mitzvah in front of you, and we're saying that on the face of it, it means you have to pay 1/3 of what you have. But how can that be? Now, Tosfos points out, the Gemara could have answered maybe that what it means is that it means the first time you pay 1/3, the second time you pay 1/3 of what's left, the third time a third of what's left of that, and so forth. Nevertheless, that would still, the Gemara knows, that would still eat up a lot of a person's resources. Fine, it wouldn't cause them to lose everything, but still, the Gemara assumes that the person is not obligated to pay that much. The Ravid makes a point, in other words, because after all, we don't want to have a person spend so much on mitzvah that he's going to be poor, and then he's going to have to take tzedakah from the tzibur. So what does it mean ad shlish? So what it means is, Ela, I'm going to say it a bit, hidur mitzvah ad shlish. What it means is, as far as hidur mitzvah, as far as to do a mitzvah in a more beautiful way, you have to be willing to add up to 1/3. Meaning, in other words, so Rashi gives an example. Suppose, for example, you have two possible Sifrei Torah that you could buy. One of them is nicer than the other. It's written more nicely. It's written on better quality parchment, whatever. You should be willing to pay up to 1/3 extra to buy that one. We know there's a concept of Zekei Liman Veyu, that you should do mitzvahs in the most beautiful possible way. But you're not obligated to spend more than 1/3 extra to do that. One second. Tosfos mentions a different example. Tosfos says, we're not talking about the quality of the mitzvah as far as, like Rashi is saying, let's say the quality of the Sefer Torah. An example would be the size. Let's say, for example, the minimum size esrog that you need on Sukkot, the halacha is, the minimum size that's kosher would be the size of a walnut. So suppose you find one esrog the size of a walnut, and you find another one that is 1/3 larger, then better you should buy that second one. If it's any smaller, if it's any less than that in size, if it's only a quarter larger, then you're not obligated to buy the bigger one. But if you have one that's 1/3 or more larger, then you should buy it.
So it's in the Chabad, that would be like bigger
tefillin? That's an example of that would be bigger tefillin, but yeah. So the Gemara asks, "Boyer of Ashi shlish milagav or shlish milabar?" What does that mean? Does it mean when we talk about fractions in Gemara, we can always talk about now. Let's say, for example, a third. When we think of a third, we think, what does it mean? For example, you have $300, so a third is 100. That's one way of looking at it. That kind is called shlish milgav, meaning from the inside, you start with the original amount, you take 1/3 of it, and then you calculate on that basis. The other way that we often talk about fractions in the Gemara is called milavar, which means we consider that the extra amount is such and such a fraction of the whole number. Meaning, in other words, that if that, in that case, if we started with 300, what would be, if we add an extra, not 100, but 150. Now, 150 is half of 300. But if we add that all together, 300 plus 150 equals 450, the extra 150 is 1/3 of the total that we're paying. So that kind of thing is called shlish milavar. So now, Rav Ashi is saying, what do we mean exactly? Well, are we talking about, for example, if the two Sifrei Torah, one is worth 300, one is worth 400, go and buy the 400 one, but you're not obligated more than that, or do we mean you're obligated to go up to 450? So that would be the difference.
Could you repeat that? Because it's very, very, very unclear. A third of a number can mean a fourth of another number. What is it's not so unclear?
Okay, think of it like this. When we talk about, for example, let's say you have a person eats truma b'shoigeg, he has to pay an extra fifth. You have a number of other cases. A person redeems hektish or ma'aser sheni, he has to pay an extra fifth. In all those cases, that fifth is milavar. It's the second way of calculating it, namely, it's a quarter of the original amount. Once you add the two numbers together, then you get it's 1/5 of the total. Let's say, for example, you have $10 worth of ma'aser sheni. If you say the din is when you're redeeming that Maaser Sheni of your own, you have to pay $12.50. Why? $12.50 extra $2.50 is a quarter of $10. But when you add the two numbers together, $10 plus $2.50, the $2.50 is one fifth of the total. So in other words, the original amount is four fifths, and the extra amount you're adding is the remaining fifth. The same way over here, you could have. Rav Ashi is saying, you could say the base price of the mitzvah is 300, let's say, and then the additional amount that you're paying is, or let's say for example 10. Let's use the same numbers. So let's say for example $10. So the base mitzvah to buy it at a basic level is $10. Then if you add another five, then what you're saying is the 10 is two thirds of what you're paying, and the extra one third is the extra $5. Are we doing it that way, or are we saying that it just means one third of the original base amount, which would be $3.33?
You're saying by the more expensive one, if it's 400.
Let's say you say a third of 100, so it can mean either 333 or what else?
Or it can mean that you're considering the 100 itself to be two thirds of the total, and then you're adding the remainder to get to.
Why would you do that? Why would you say that a third of 100?
That's what I'm saying.
I don't understand.
We do find in many cases in halacha that is how fractions are calculated in halacha. As far as Maaser Sheni, as far as Hekdesh, as far as Einah, as far as a variety of other things in halacha, we often find, more often than not, we find that a fraction is calculated that way. In the Levar, that you take the fraction as the fraction of the total amount that you're paying rather than of the original amount. So in our example, with $10, let's say, shlish milavar, which is the same way as with Maaser Sheni, again, the same way as $10 becomes $12.50 rather than $12, the same way over here. We would say $10 becomes $15 rather than $13.33. There's logic to say that. On the other hand, maybe not. Maybe over here we are talking about the lesser amount. Maybe over here we're talking about that the base amount is $10. You're being told you have to be willing to add another $3.33. So what is it?
In both cases, you're paying.
So you're saying when you say a third of 100, it means the 100 can be the whole amount, or the 100 can be the third of an unknown amount?
No. So I'm not making it clear, I guess. Let me try again. Let's use one base number. Let's use either 100 or 1,000 or 300, or either 10 or 100 or 300. Let's not mix up a bunch of different numbers. Let's take 300 because it divides neatly into a whole number. So let's say, for example,
A third of 300
is 100. But the other way of looking at it is you can say you start with the 300, divide it by 3, and then you're adding that on top of the 300. Or what you can say is you consider the 300 to be two-thirds of the total that you're paying. Well, if 300 is two-thirds, that means that means one-third is going to be 150. Therefore, you're adding that extra third. You're coming out with 450 total, of which that 150 is one-third of the total amount you're paying, and the 300, which is the base price, is the original amount that you would have been paying for the mitzvah on a basic level.
By one case, the first case, they pay 100.
So in the first case, you'd be paying total 400. In the second case, you'd be paying total 450. Yeah.
By Maaser Sheni,
you don't. By Maaser Sheni, you definitely say that it means milavar. If you have $300 worth of Maaser Sheni, what you're doing is you're dividing 300 by 4, which gives you 75, and you're paying 375 to redeem that $300 worth of Maaser Sheni. There's no question about that. You definitely don't do it the other way. You definitely do it milavar. Here the question is, are you also doing that, therefore winding up with 450, or are you not and winding up with 400?
Now, if you have money that's Maaser, do you have to do that?
Maaser Sheni nowadays is a whole other matter because you can't bring it to your shalayim. Maaser of your money is 10%. That's 10%. Okay. Right. So Rashi is asking what the din. And the Gemara answers teku, we have to leave it uncertain. The Mephoshim say since we're talking something only dirabbanan, and therefore you can be makel, and you can say it's shlishmilagav. So therefore, so in practice, then that would mean that. Continues the Gemara.
Let's do the calculation again. It's very, very confusing. A third of 300 could mean either 100 or
or it can
which is a half of 100,
but which is a third.
Where do you get the 150 from?
You add the two numbers together.
Where do you get the 150 from? What is the 150 that you're talking about?
What is 150 plus 300? What are those two numbers added together?
150 is the half of 300.
What
it's not
is
a third.
150 plus 300? What is the total of those two numbers together?
450, so.
And what is 150 of 450? What is that fraction?
But we said a third of 300, not a third of 450.
No, we said there's two possibilities. It could be one third of 300, or it could be one third of the total once we're adding the two numbers together, the base price plus the extra that you're adding. We can say that the extra amount is one-third of that new total, meaning that we're taking the original amount to be two-thirds of the new total and the additional amount that we're adding being the remaining third.
Okay. It's just a construct that's not...
Okay. Let me explain it one more time. Let me explain it one more time, and then we need to go on. You're saying...
Divide the initial number in two...
Okay, listen.
Go ahead.
Listen. You have in front of you an esrog. The basic esrog that you could buy, hypothetically, is $300. Now you have in front of you a nicer esrog, and the question is whether you're obligated to buy it. There are two ways of looking at it. You can say the base price that I would pay is $300. I'm obligated to add up to a third, Argamada is saying. Very well, a third of 300 is 100. Therefore, I should be willing to pay up to $400 for a nicer esrog. The other way of looking at it is, and that's, that kind of thing is called shlish milagav. The other way of looking at it is, I'm going to say, I'm going to end up that I should be willing to pay for this esrog is such that the base price would be two thirds of what I end up paying. That means, in other words, we're going to take that 300, we're going to divide it into, we're going to figure out what we're going to do an equation over here. 300 is two thirds of what? And once we figure that out, we're going to have 1 second. We're going to answer. The answer is going to be 300 is two thirds of 450. Therefore, we're going to say the total price that I should be willing to pay for Hiddur Mitzvah will be 450. What does that mean? It means I'm paying an extra 150. Out of that 450, I'm paying 300, which is two thirds, is the base price, and 150, which I'm paying the extra, is the extra amount that I'm paying. So therefore, 150 can also be described as one third, not one third relative to the base price, but one third relative to the total price I'm paying.
So instead of paying 100,
you should pay. Well, you can say. Yeah, with that logic, you can say one third can mean also that the total price is 900. 300 is a third of 900. You can go infinity with that.
There's no reason to say that. There's no reason to say that because that's not what we're saying. Add shlish means that you should be willing to say that either that you're adding an extra third. The extra third can either be relative to the base price or it can be relative to the total price. There's no other way to say it. If it said add shlosh upon, you have a point, but that's not what it says. Okay, the Gemara continues. In the West, meaning in Eretz Yisrael, they said in the name of Rav Zeira, ad shlish mishaloi, up to a third extra, however we define a third, as we just discussed, has to come out of a person's own resources. And there, so Rashi explains, in other words, a person is not getting extra schar for that in this world. They'll get extra schar for it in Olam Haba, but not in this world. Mikan ve'elach, mishalach kodesh baruch hu. Beyond that, if a person does go beyond that, then Hashem is going to pay him back in this world. That's how Rashi explains. Tosfos says similarly, it means this is going to be an example of that the person will get a schar for it in this world as well as in Olam Haba. There are other explanations among Rishonim what this Mishaloy and Mishal HaKadosh Baruch Hu means. Rabbi Hananel says over here that what it means is that if a person is richer, then he should be obligated to go beyond the one third. If a person is not so rich, then then he shouldn't have, to go any more, then he shouldn't have to go any more than one third. And other Mephoshim say in a similar vein that it means that the Mishaloy and Mishal HaKadosh Baruch Hu means that, so it can mean that he's not obligated to, but it means also if, for example, Hashem gave him, so Rabbeinu Hananel says, let's say, for example, a person has a windfall, a person came into a windfall, so now he should go beyond that in Hidur Mitzvah and go beyond the Shlish.
If a person has not too much money and does the mitzvah,
he does what with whatever resources he has, then yeah, what we're saying is he should go beyond a little bit beyond what he can. But obviously, yeah, if he's poor and he doesn't have enough, then yeah, then I'll have to stick to the basic mitzvah. Okay. Mishnah says. Mishnah continues. Here's more basic rules about nizikin, which after all is the subject of our Masechta. The Mishnah says, "Kol shechavti b'shmirasei, anything that I am obligated to guard it, is shauti es nizkai. Then, but if I fail to guard it, then I have made possible that nezik, and therefore, in other words, I'm responsible for paying back that nezik." That's Rashi's first explanation. Rashi's second explanation, "Shauti," means I have to fix up the results of it. I am going to be obligated to pay because I didn't take care. The Mishnah continues, if I enabled part of the nezek, then I become obligated to pay for the entire nezek as though I had enabled the entire nezek. We'll see on Daf Yud, we'll learn tomorrow, Bess Hashem, what exactly that means. On the face of it, why is a person chayev for the entire nezek if he only enabled part of it? We'll see tomorrow in the Gemara, Bess Hashem, what that means. The Mishnah continues, here are the cases where, what kind of nechosim is a person obligated to pay for the nezek of. It has to be nechosim she'en behem me'ilah. First of all, it has to be property to which me'ilah does not apply, meaning not hekdesh. As we learned the other day in the Gemara, if a person causes nezek, a person or his property causes damage to hekdesh, he's not obligated to pay. Sometimes he's chayev for me'ilah, that's a different matter, but if my shur goes and gores a shur that belongs to Hekdesh, I will be potter. We learned the opinion of Reb Shimon Manasseh, who says otherwise, but the halacha is not like that. Nechosim shehen shal b'nei bris. Furthermore, the property has to belong to a ben bris, meaning a fellow yid. We're going to learn later in the Masechta that you're not allowed to cause nezakim to a goy, but the dinim of paying for the nezek are not the same for a yid as for a goy. So here the Mishnah is saying that in brief. Similarly, nechosim hamyuchodim, it has to be property that has a specific owner, meaning not hefter, for example. If I damage the property of hefter, then I don't have to pay. Now, on the face of it, that's obvious. Who am I going to pay? So we'll see in the Gemara what that means. And now the Mishnah is going to talk about where does the concept of nezikin apply. Over chol makim, it applies in any place, no matter where my mammon, wherever something of mine causes hezek, then I'm going to be liable to pay. Chutz mirashus hamiyuchedes hamazik, with the exception of a reshus that is designated, that belongs exclusively to the mazik, meaning, in other words, if you're sure goes into my property and my shur injures your, I will be potter, because I have every right to say your shur had no business being in my property in the first place, and there's no reason I should be liable because your shur wandered into my property. If he gave him permission, then that's different. If he gave him permission, I'm going to talk about those dinim later in the Masechta. But the basic idea is, if it's my reshus, then I'm potter from nizikin there as a general rule. Or reshus ha-nizik b'hamazik, and also, you have a case of a reshus that belongs equally to the nizik and the mazik. We're going to see in the Gemara what that means. We're going to have a couple of different opinions in that Gemara. Is that also a case where I'm potter, or is that a case where I would be chayev? We'll see about that in the Gemara. And the Mishnah finishes off, in all the cases where the person is chayev, kishehizik, if my mammon causes a damage to yours, chav hamazik l'shalom b'shalom nezik meitav aretz, then the mazik is going to be liable to pay for the nezik with the best of his land, as we learned in the previous Gemara, and the Gemara pointed out a few blots earlier, that this phrase of the Mishnah comes to include another kind of nezek that has been talking of, that we haven't talked about until now. Either it comes to include where an animal gores, which we, according to one, we had a machlokas Rav and Shmuel the other day, when we said in the first Mishnah Mav'eh, when we said Shur and we said Mav'eh, what did it mean? Did Shur mean when an animal gores with its horns, and Mav'eh means when it eats with its teeth? Or, and in that case, our Mishnah is adding also regal, or is it that, or when animal tramples with its feet, or is it that shur meant any way in which an animal damages, odam meant any way in which an animal damages in a normal way, with its teeth or with its feet, and maba meant a person causing damage, and then our Mishnah is coming to include keren, that also in that case, there's a few.
Okay. And we're talking about
chazaka? No, chazaka, one So, and whatever, no, time or more, whatever, either way, this is fair, yeah. Okay, so the Gemara starts off. Tanabon. What does the first line of our Mishnah mean? Any place where I am obligated in guarding it, then if I haven't done that, I've hichshauti the nezek, where we said hichshauti has two possible meanings. It can mean that I have enabled the nezek, and therefore I'm chayev, or it can mean it is my responsibility to make good, to compensate for the nezek. Anyway, what does that mean? Ketzad. For example, shur ubur shemoser mecheres shur tivakatan. Suppose that I have a shur, or suppose that I have a bur, a pit in the ground, if I gave it over to a cheresh or a shoyta or a cotton to take care of them, the hiziku, when they cause damage, the owner of that shur or the owner of that bur will be obligated to pay masha'enken be'esh. As opposed to, the Bryce says, it is not like that when it comes to fire. Now, why not? We're going to have to explain that.
Okay, so if a shetach has an animal somehow.
If they have an animal, then they have an apotropos taking care of it. But we're talking about then we can't be machayev. We can't be machayev. Then they're not bnei das.
So then people would just say, I'm going to give them my animals.
That's the point. In other words, if I have an animal and I give it to a cheresh shoytim cotton to wash, I will be chayev. That's what we're saying. Masha'en can be'esh, as opposed to it's not like that with fire. Well, the Gemara asks, let's figure that out. But my eskin, what's the scenario? Are we talking about where the animal is tied up or the pit is covered? And you're going to say that nevertheless, if I give them to a cheder shirt of a cotton, then I'm still chayev. Well, to kavasah gabe esh, what would be the parallel with fire? Gacheles would be where I give them a coal, which is not an open flame. I'm just giving them a burning coal. Okay. Well, maishna hocha, maishna hocha. Then what's the difference? Why should I be chayev for the shirt of bur and potter for the coal? Either way, I did my part to guard it, and why should I be chayev in the one case and not in the other? Meaning, in other words, Tosfos says, if I didn't tie them up properly, if I didn't cover the pit properly, of course I'm chayev. We're talking about if I tied up the shur properly and I covered the burr properly, why should I be chayev? Just I'm asking a cher shur to a cotton to watch them.
Then if I can see the pit.
Well, that's what we have to figure out. Ella b'shur mutter b'r megula. Are we talking about that I gave him an untied ox or an uncovered pit to cover sagabe ish shalheves? So then the parallel with a fire would be where I give him an open flame. Well then, why with a flame? Then in that case, mashenken be'esh to potter, why would I be potter in the case of a flame? Well, Amr b'shlokish mishmei de Chizkia, didn't b'shlokish say in the name of Chizkia, loishonu al shemosel gachelos v'liba, when we talk about later on, in the Masechta, when we talk about in the next perek, we're going to talk about a case where a person sends a fire with a cheresh shoyta of a cotton, and then later on in the Masechta, we're going to learn he's potter midine adam, he's potter based in can't obligate him to pay, but he's chayav midine shemayim. But Rish Lakish is saying loshanu elok shemosel gachelus v'liba. That would only be if he gave him a coal and then the cheresh shoyta of a cotton blew on it and then made the fire flare up and then he caused damage with it. Then I can say I'm potter because I didn't give him an open flame. Avol shall have a chayev, but if I gave him an open flame, then I would be chayev. My time of the habori hezekah, because then the hezekah is clearly open and obvious. So what are we saying? So what is the scenario where with a shur and bur I'd be chayev for giving it to a cheder shur of a cotton, but with a fire I would be potter in a similar case? What is the similar case that we would say? So the answer is la'olam b'shur kosher bur mechusa. In fact, we are talking about the ox is tied up. The pit is covered. The difference is, and by a fire, we're talking about that he gave him a coal. The difference is, you're arguing, so what's the difference? Why in the case of the shur and bird am I chayim? Why in the case of the coal am I potter? The difference is, shur doubtly than a tuki. Because an ox is regularly going to, is regularly going to break free of the rope that you tie it up with. So even, in other words, even if the cheresh, or the, even if a cheresh straight to the cotton is not going to untie it, on its own, it can end up getting untied. So therefore, it was a very weak kind of shmira. I should have given it to a ben das to keep an eye on it. I gave it to a cheresh. Therefore, I should be chayev for 1 second. Therefore, I should be chayev for that. And similarly, bur dark in the naturi. Similarly, with a bur, it's very common that the cover over the bur falls in. So therefore, so regardless whether the cheresh actually untied the ox or uncovered the pit, or whether he didn't and it just got untied or uncovered on its own, either way, I should be chayev because I gave it to somebody who's not a ben das. As opposed to gachelas, as opposed to a coal, kamada shavik lama amya amya v'ozla. If you don't do anything to a coal, it will get dimmer and dimmer and go out on its own. You need to do something to a coal in order to make the fire flare up. If you just leave a coal, if you just leave it, eventually it'll go out on its own. So unlike a bur or a shur,
well, not necessarily. What about if the coal is next to a wooden wall of a home?
Well, if you gave it to a cheresh straight to a cotton and it was next to a wooden wall, we're not talking about that. Of course, you chayev. We're talking about you gave him a coal. You gave him a pan with a coal inside it. If he goes and causes the coal to flare up and then causes damage with it, you'll be potter midini adam because that's what we're saying over here. You gave him something which on its own would end up going out. But if you, as opposed to you gave him an open flame, as opposed to with a shur and a bur, what we're saying is there's a high likelihood that the shur or the bur will end up causing damage just on their own, even without the cheresh doing anything. Therefore, you would be chayev for giving it to the cheresh in the first place.
You could say two things. One, it's very strong-willed.
Even if it's a strong rope. Now, Tosfos, even so, a rope can eventually deteriorate. With that said, though, Tosfos says that actually, no. What we can say is, the point we would be saying is the fact that the cheresh is not like that. Tosfos learned not like Rashi. We don't mean that the rope may come undone on its own or the burr may get uncovered on its own. We mean the cheresh shirt of a cotton is more likely to untie it. It's not normal for him. It's not as expected of him that he would go blow on the coal and cause it to flare up. But it is much more likely that he would go and untie the shur or take off the cover over the burr. So therefore, you have more reason to be chayev.
How
do you untie? What do you mean? Chayev is capable of doing things.
That's
deaf mute. He's not blind yet.
So
that's according to the Shlokish. On the other hand, what about, so that would work then according to the Shlokish's opinion. So according to the Shlokish's opinion that there's a difference between giving a better shirt of a cotton of coal versus an open flame, then we can explain the difference. What about Rabbi Yochanan and Amar Afilu Masal Shal Heves Nami Potter? Now on the other hand, Rabbi Yochanan holds that even with a shirt of a cotton, Rabbi Yochanan says even if you give him an open flame, you're also going to be potter because the fact is, you gave him a flame, but on the other hand, it's he who goes and sets the fire. He didn't do it as a shliach of yours. So then, to have a sahach of a shur mutter a bur megula. So here, the parallel with a shur and a bur would have to be the shur is untied, the bur is uncovered. Maishna hocha. So again, you have to ask then, what's the difference? Why in the case of the shur and bur would he be chayev? Why in the case of the flame would Rabbi Yochanan say he's potter? And the answer is hosam savsa the cheresh kagorin. Because in the case of the flame, the cheresh holding on to it, sabsa means that he's holding on to it. Rashi compares it to the word svas, which means like a pair of pliers. So because the cheresh is holding it is what causes it to cause damage. So in other words, therefore, it's not completely your responsibility because the cheresh is involved as well. On the other hand, here the cheresh does not have to be involved. The shur or the bur on its own caused the damage. Therefore, you have to be chayev. So Rashi, by the way, gives a second point. The word may not be tsavsa, as in tsvas, like a pliers, but rather tsavsa, like the joining. Like we say, mitzvah moshen tsavsa v'chibur. The joining together of the cheresh and the flame is necessary in order for it to cause damage, as opposed to the shur and the bur not. So in other words, Tosfos explains, it comes out, in effect, that Rabbi Yochanan and Rish Lakish have opposite svaris. Rabbi Yochanan would hold that giving the shur or the bur is a little bit, Tosfos explains that when you give it to the cheresh shur to the cotton, you are doing a certain degree of shmirah. You are doing a certain degree of guarding it because you are giving it to somebody at least to watch. The problem is you didn't give it to a Ben Das, and therefore you're chayav for whatever happens with the Shor and this is Bur. On the other hand, the Shlokish is taking the view, on the according to Tosfos' understanding, on the contrary, giving it to a Cheresh Shor to Bekotten is worse than no Shmir at all. Because at least with no Shmir at all, they may, at least if you tie up the animal and you don't give it to a Cheresh Shor to Bekotten, nothing may happen. But if you tie it up and give it to a Cheresh Shor to Bekotten, they're more likely to untie it. So Rabbi Yochanan, in other words, is holding that. So in either case, Rabbi Yochanan would say, whether the animal was tied or untied, you're talking about you give it to a cheresh shor to a cotton, you're still chayev. And on the other hand, Rish Lakish would say that, and in the case of a flame, even if you gave him an open flame, you're also potter, because again, the flame takes, it has to go together with the cheresh in order to cause damage, with the case of the shor or the bor not. On the other hand, Rish Lakish would say that we're talking about you gave him a tied up shor or covered up bor, and nevertheless you chayev, either because like Rashi says, the rope or the cover tends to deteriorate over time, or according to Tosfos, because they're actually likely to untie it or open it up.
You could say, by the case of Rosh Hashanah, that if he's going to fall into a pit, who's going to come?
If you open up a pit and a shor falls into it, you're chayav because you opened up a pit.
But it's
if you opened up the bur, and if you have a bur, and you gave it to a cheresh shor to a cotton to watch, we're saying you, if you have a bur, you dug a bur. You dug a bur in Rosh Hashanah. And you dug a bird in Rosh Hashanah.
Yeah.
According to the Shlokish, we're talking about even though you covered it, because you gave it to a cheresh shor to a cotton, you are chayev. According to the Yochanan, what you're chayev for anybody's shor who falls into it. According to Rabbi Yochanan, if you gave him an uncovered one, you're going to be chayev. But if you had covered it, Rabbi Yochanan might say that you're potter.
What are we saying by cheresh shor to a cotton?
You're giving him the bur to watch. You're telling him you watch this bur and make sure that it stays covered. And then if a shor falls into that bur, then you're going to be chayev. You're the owner of the bur.
Chayev
for what? For the damages to the shor that fell in there.
But you're going to pay yourself if you have that shor.
If your own shor falls into your bur, we're not talking about that. We're talking about you have a bur and somebody else's shor falls into it. Okay. So we'll continue tomorrow, Best Hashem, talking about more of these dinim of shor and bur and the various other nizakin, and go on to discuss more of what this Mishnah is talking about as far as your responsibility to prevent nizakin.
But if you're
just a second.
6:45.
Best Hashem, yes.